You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Rolling Stone magazine put out a list of the top 100 sitcoms of all time. We want you to call in with your favorites. Now, two Wisconsin lawmakers visited Texas in early May to get a sense of the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. Customs and Border Patrol reports that the agency encountered more than 172,000 undocumented immigrants at the southern border in March. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk to an immigration expert about what's going on at the southern border. First, we'll hear from Representative Tyler August. He's the Speaker pro tempore and a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 32nd Assembly District, which includes Lake Geneva. He visited the border with Representative Jim Steinecke. I talked to Representative August earlier today. Here's our conversation. So what led you and your colleague to make this visit to the U.S.-Mexico border?
We were talking about the issues that were going on down there, and I spoke with Jason Isaac from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, who's been a friend of mine for a long time, and he offered to set up a trip for us to come down there and actually talk with local law enforcement, Border Patrol, customs agents, as well as local landowners to get a feel for just how bad the crisis is down there. So we made the trip down almost 2 weeks ago now.
And what kind of things did you hear from, especially those local residents there, about what they're seeing?
Well, pretty much everybody we talked to said that this is the worst that they've ever seen it, especially the ranchers in the area that have ranches right out along the Rio Grande. We were about 3 hours west of San Antonio in the Del Rios area, Valverde County. And these are multi-generational ranchers that have been on this land for generations. And they all said that this is the worst they've ever seen it. There was a group of about a little over 70 people that we were speaking with from the area. We asked them how many were afraid on their own property, and almost every hand in the room went up. And that was kind of shocking to me because these are not weak individuals. These are some hardcore Texas ranchers, and for them to be afraid for themselves and their family on their own land is a tough way to live. And so that was one of the more shocking pieces of the trip, although there were plenty of things that surprised me.
What kind of things surprised you?
Well, I think just how bad the situation is. We were a Democrat Sheriff Martinez of Valverde County hosted us the first day in his county and showed us the areas right along the Rio Grande where the illegal immigrants are crossing. And when we were standing there on the river, a couple of individuals showed up on the other side of the river coming up over the hill, a couple of young males. And I asked the sheriff what he thought that was. And he said, well, they're probably the cartel smugglers or coyotes, if you will. I said, also, are they checking it out to make sure that, you know, we're not here? They'll probably send a group over once we leave. And he said, they don't care if we're standing here. They're checking the river level. He said that I could be standing here with all my deputies in Border Patrol and they'll send the group right over because they know that they're not going to get sent back, that they're going to be processed and then moved on. They'll be released and move on all across the country. So just how brazen the cartel smugglers are when it comes to this, they've really turned it into a business. And that's a piece of the story that I think gets missed a lot of times.
What are you hoping to see from the Biden administration on the border?
Well, I think a good step would be to have the vice president actually visit the border. The president put the vice president in charge of this situation, and she has yet to visit it, which is unfortunate because I think anybody who actually sets foot down there and sees what the local law enforcement and the local landowners are dealing with would realize what a crisis this situation really is. So that'd be a great first step to actually be on the ground and see how bad this crisis really is, and then do some things to rectify it. Go back to some of the other policies from the previous administration would be helpful. And it's just unfortunate that we're in a situation that's not happening, and this situation's getting worse, not better.
Talking to Wisconsin State Assembly Representative Tyler August, a Republican from the Lake Geneva area, talking about a visit he made to the U.S.-Mexico border a couple weeks back. You have also called for the state of Wisconsin to offer whatever aid it can. What kind of things did you have in mind?
Yeah, and I think that that's an important piece. I mean, the federal government, our leaders in Washington are unfortunately not leading on this issue. So I think it's up to the states to step forward. Now, it's obviously, it should be a federal issue. This isn't something that Texas or any of the other border states should have to deal with on their own, because it affects certainly all 48 lower states. We spoke with a Border Patrol agent who used to be stationed in the North Dakota area, and he told us that the vast majority of interactions that he had with people in the country illegally didn't come in from Canada. They came in from the southern border. So obviously these folks are making their way into the southern United States, but they are going all over the country from there. So it becomes an issue that every state has to deal with. So if there's no leadership in Washington on this issue, I believe that Wisconsin should step up and do our part. I believe that the governor should get on the phone with some of the governors of the border states and ask them what kind of assistance they need, because they are just completely overrun right now. And that was very clear while we were down there, that there are so many individuals coming over. There's nine sectors in the that the Border Patrol has split the border into, nine different sectors. Just in the sector that we were in, it's estimated about 800 illegal aliens are crossing the border every day. It is really a bad situation down there. So, and the other piece of this is, it is definitely a national security issue, but I think that the piece that people don't really reflect on is that it's a humanitarian crisis as well. A lot of times these individuals are paying the Mexican cartels to get them across the border, and they can spend up to $5,000 a person, it's been reported, to get across the border. And a lot of these folks, they don't have $5,000. So they end up in a situation where they're basically indentured servants working for the cartels once they cross over into the United States until they can pay off their debt. And that's not a situation we should be letting anyone be in. So we need to secure the border and stop this situation, not just from a national security perspective, but it's also the right thing to do from a humanitarian side.
On the humanitarian angle, when I've talked to people familiar with these Central American countries that are really the source of a lot of this migration, they're pointing to ongoing poverty and violence, plus two hurricanes back-to-back in November and December. That's driving a lot of the decisions for people to make this, as you say, dangerous trip to try to get across the border. Do you see a role as part of this for U.S. help to try to make things better in the countries of origin here?
Well, I think that it's important to note that I believe in legal immigration. We have a system that's set up to allow these folks that are fleeing some terrible situations to come here legally. And, you know, not just from a workforce perspective, we need immigrants in the workforce, but it's also the right thing to do to take care of some of these individuals that are fleeing just absolutely atrocious situations. But there's a legal way of doing that, and that's what we need to continue to let people know, is that they need to go through the proper legal channels to take care of some of this. Now, you are right that a lot of this is from Central America. I think a mistake that most Americans make is that they assume that every illegal alien coming across the southern border is from Mexico, and that's, while there is a good-sized percentage of them that do, it's also from Central America, and we also learned, and this was surprising to me, that it's from actually all over the world. Just in the sector we were in, Border Patrol has encountered people from 67 different countries. So this is not just Central America. I mean, they've encountered people from Iraq, Russia, China, Syria, Cuba, Haiti. I mean, you name a country, and the odds are pretty good that the Border Patrol in this sector has run across individuals from there. So It's certainly a Central American issue, but it's also a global issue. And what concerns me is some of those countries that I listed off, there are individuals within the borders of those countries that don't look too favorably upon the United States. And it concerns me what kind of individuals are coming in from those countries and what their intent may be when they get here.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative August, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you having me.
That was State Assembly Representative Tyler August. I talked to him earlier today about his recent visit to the U.S.-Mexico border with his Republican colleague, Representative Jim Steinecke. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the factors playing a role in what we're seeing at the southern border with an immigration expert. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. Geronimo Cortina joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about immigration and border policy from the Trump to the Biden administrations? What do you want to know about the latest at the border? Are there policy changes you'd like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Geronimo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
We just heard from a state lawmaker from here in Wisconsin about what he saw on a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border. You're in Texas. You've been following this issue. What have you been seeing over this last 2 months or so now?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is a very complicated situation, and obviously, it's a very politicized situation. And, you know, the outcomes that we're seeing today are not simply because of the changes in administration. We have seen these spiral over the past months and years, given the implementations and the policies that the Trump administration had. Obviously, whether we agree or not, that's, I guess, a different question. But those changes in policy had these implications. And also the fact that we had the perfect storm and the perfect conditions in Central America for people to migrate, right? And we need to understand to a certain extent why people are migrating. People basically migrate due to the inequalities between, particularly in this case, Central America, the Northern Triangle countries, and the United States. And these differences in the quantity and the quality of opportunities, and the differences in terms of public safety, economic opportunities, the issue that you mentioned in terms of having back-to-back hurricanes propel people to send basically their kids to take a very, very, very dangerous journey, thousands of miles in very precarious conditions to try and make it to the United States where they think they're going to have a better chance of having a better life.
One concern that's been raised, including in part by our last guest, was that the policies of the Biden administration look, at least on their face, more welcoming. Is that a message you think is reaching people in Central America, factoring into the math of whether they take that huge risk or send their kid on that difficult journey, that the outcome when they reach the U.S. is going to be better now than it might have been in the Trump administration?
Well, I think, you know, in previous administrations, even the Obama administration and before that, they have tried to have, you know, public awareness messages in countries of origin saying, don't come to the United States. Our immigration policy is a very complicated piece of legislation. It's a very complicated policy. And those efforts have not proven to exert significant changes in people's predispositions to migrate. Again, we're thinking about three countries primarily in the Northern Triangle countries in Central America that have been hit extremely, extremely hard. Violence, natural disasters, now COVID-19, so on and so forth. So the calculations that parents particularly are making when we're talking about unaccompanied minors is that it's better to risk their lives and their children's lives to have that journey to move forward. I don't think that the Biden administration, or for that matter, the Trump administration or any administration, have sent a message to other people living in other countries that we have a welcoming immigration policy, because our immigration policy has not changed in the past 30 years. So our immigration policy is not welcoming like you can make an argument for other Western democracies that may have something more welcoming than one we have today on the books.
Geronimo, our last guest mentioned legal immigration being something we should encourage as opposed to attempting to enter the country and seek asylum and possibly stay in the country illegally. I've heard some people make the case like, okay, we need to allow a little more legal immigration, but also make it possible to apply under the normal system or even apply for asylum from the country of origin more easily so that in those northern Central American countries you were talking about, somebody can start the process there, wait there instead of undertaking this huge journey, maybe at the risk of being harmed by cartels. Is that something you think might help?
Well, I think, first of all, our immigration system needs to be rethought since, comprehensively speaking. Our immigration policy is an immigration policy that is completely outdated. It's outdated to our times. It's outdated to our labor market needs. Your previous guest, representative from State Assembly, mentioned something very interesting. We need migrants. We need migrants because our labor needs are completely different in such states like Wisconsin and Texas. We have different labor needs that those needs can be filled with migrant labor. So the first thing that we need to do, I think, from a policy perspective, is sit down at the table and discuss the policy without politics. I know this is, perhaps a very wild dream, but this is what we need to sit and start discussing. In terms of asylum policy, our asylum policy is not very welcoming in terms of that. Asylum policy allows an individual, international covenants, the International Organization for Migration, the United Nations Refugee Office, so on and so forth, allow people to move and escape danger. So allowing a process that you would have the person to stay in their home country to apply for asylum that usually takes between 2 and 3 years, right, is not going to have a significant impact in helping people, get away from harm's way. So that's something that could be implemented. But the real question is, how do you ensure that that particular person or group of persons are going to be held in a safe environment while they are applying for asylum, whether it's here in the United States or any other part in the of the world?
Let's bring on a caller now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. Given the worldwide situation with climate change, people in the United States, particularly in the government, need to understand, and I think they do, that immigration pressure is only going to increase on the United States, and it's going to increase dramatically. People from all over the world, as Representative August was saying, it's not just from Central and South America, Mexico. It's worldwide, and the United States needs to dramatically increase the quotas of legal immigrants that are allowed into the country to try to deal with the immigration problem. At the same time, I wanted to just make this comment to Representative August, since he's so concerned about what Wisconsin can do about the problem. He could act here in Wisconsin to try to prosecute the dairy farmers and the meat packers that hire the illegal aliens, the undocumented workers, to work in the industry. It's well known that many of the people that work in the dairy industry are people that are undocumented.
Ben, I'm going to jump in because you gave us a lot with just a few minutes left there. First of all, Geronimo, Ben says we should increase our legal immigration numbers.
Well, I mean, that's another way. And another way is to simply not just by increasing the numbers, right, but allowing a market to determine the numbers that we need in order to have more migrants. We're facing a labor shortage. We saw the numbers of the 2020 census that we had the lowest fertility rates in the past 40 years or something like that. Total fertility rates are not being incorporated into the labor market, and the replacement of the population has, or it will have, very important consequences for our economic future. So increasing the numbers not only is a matter of national security eventually, but it also is going to ensure how competitive, economically speaking, we are as a nation.
And then to Ben's second point about employers here in Wisconsin or around the country who hire either knowingly or with kind of a wink, undocumented workers, and Ben saying maybe we need to address that.
Well, I mean, it's an issue, right? And it's an issue because those employers, I'm not condoning if it's right or wrong. I'm just stating the facts that they need people to work the fields, or in this case, the dairies in Wisconsin. So if you're not having, if you're not finding enough human capital, if you're not finding enough workers to do the job that needs to be done, you're going to be resorting to perhaps hiring undocumented migrants. And that has important consequences, not only legally speaking, but also for their migrants that are perhaps not paid, you know, competitive wages or have access to healthcare, so on and so forth. But this is an illustration, very important illustration, that the immigration system, H-1B visas, workers visas, agricultural visas, it's a very complicated process and it's very tiresome and imposes a significant burden on people that need to have that labor in order to be successful in their businesses.
Briefly, Geronimo, you said, can we tackle these policies and set aside the politics? Just in our last half a minute, do you think that's possible?
Given the current political climate, I think it's not going to be quite possible yet. But we need to start the conversation. We need to try to depoliticize the issue of immigration that touches many, many other public policy areas, such as, for example, social security, healthcare, community development, so on and so forth. So we really need to step aside from the political arena and try to get a policy discussion on what is best for us as a country.
Geronimo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. His research interests include American and Latino politics and immigration. He joined us to talk about the latest news over the last couple of months at the U.S.-Mexico border. Coming up, we'll learn more about the challenges facing loons here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Rolling Stone magazine came out with its best TV sitcoms of all time list. They've got 100 of them. We want to hear from you about your favorite sitcom. You could even pick two. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your favorite TV situation comedy of all time. We'll take your calls coming up. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story as we come out of Mother's Day weekend.
A mother's voice can wrap us in warm blankets. It can guide gently or yank us back from the cliff. And sometimes it can take us places we only dreamed were possible. Jan Larson and her three grown children remember a mother's voice.
Our children are grown. The magic is packed in cardboard boxes and tucked away in the loft, waiting for the next generation to reveal its secrets. The Snuggler, an oversized chair that once cradled the Larsons five each night before sleep claimed our three young ones, sits empty in the corner of our living room. But once upon a time, those twilight hours held the promise of adventure, of magic, of silly laughter, as my husband and I beckoned our pajama-clad pirates to join us in the joy of reading. And when the clamor for, "Just one more, Mommy!" rang out, I didn't mind a bit.
Dina, what do you remember about being read to as a child?
You did voices. And now whenever I read to friends or loved ones, I do voices. And it makes all the difference. It's even more immersive. And it's funny because just like I associate certain characters in some of my favorite stories from my childhood with you, some of the favorite characters in stories that I've shared with friends or loved ones since then are now associated with my voice and my mannerisms.
Gray, what are you thinking about? How did reading make you feel?
I just wanted to speak to what Dana said, because Dana and I read together, and I read sometimes, but most often I like when Dana reads because he's better at the voices.
Ellie, what do you remember about the Larson's Five reading together at night?
We were living on our sailboat together and found a copy of the seventh Harry Potter book. And by that time, two of us were teenagers already, but we still loved having you read to us. And we made you read that book for hours on end because we were so desperate to hear more of the story. And I couldn't get our hands on enough copies for all of us to have separately. And I remember you begging us to let you take a break so that you could get food and some water.
Yes, I remember that very well. And then what did you do that night after I'd gone to bed? Because I went to bed with the book and hid it under my pillow.
Well, your point was to make it fair so that nobody could read ahead. But I snuck it out from under your pillow and stayed up all night reading it.
I distinctly remember being at the end of a chain of theft. Ellie would steal the book from Mom and read it, and then Gray would procure the book from Ellie and read it. And the whole time that they were reading it would be pouting at them disapprovingly, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading ahead, okay? This is for Mom to read."
What he meant was, we weren't supposed to be reading ahead of Dana.
Yeah, not without me.
Do you think ahead to maybe having your own families and what you'll do then?
Yes, bring them over so that you can read to them too.
I'll be happy to. I will be happy to. And then it will be a grandmother's voice. That will be a fun thing.
Well, you're going to have to wait a while for that. That's not coming anytime soon.
That's okay. That'll be worth the wait. Thanks so much. It is always a pleasure to get to read to you, and I hope that you have good memories of feeling warm and loved.
We always do.
They're all of the best memories.
You gave us all the good things that we have.
Oh, I love you, kids.
Love you, Mom.
We love you, Mom.
Aren't you going to say your signature line?
Oh. Thanks for making us.
And they all lived happily in harmony and peace ever after.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Rolling Stone released its list of the top 100 TV sitcoms last week. I clicked on a link to the list over the weekend and all their write-ups and thought, I'm not going to waste my time on this. Fast forward 20 minutes or so, and yeah, I looked through the whole thing. There are classics like Sanford and Son, new shows like Veep made the cut, shows old and new, popular and obscure, live action and animated, all made the list. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What goes on top of your favorite sitcom list? Or do you have a lesser known one that you'd like to get in there somewhere? What sitcoms do you recommend a time and time again or go back and watch maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is there one you're binge watching now? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Kevin is with us driving through the state. Kevin, hi.
Good afternoon. I have two. MASH is number one. My father served in Korea. He's 93. He's still alive. I was in the Air Force. I worked in the operating room. And I enjoyed MASH. I always have. I still watch it. Every night, I watch at least one episode of it.
All right, you said you had two shows, Kevin. What's your second one?
The Addams Family.
Okay, now MASH was number six on the list. Addams Family, I've been reading comments. There are some shows that people feel were unjustly left off. I'm afraid Addams Family was number one. I got to ask you, Kevin, you worked in an operating room in the military. Do you feel like MASH kind of got it right?
Well, back then, yes. In 1980s, no.
Check.
But you have to realize that was in the Army, 1951, 1950. And that's exactly how it was back then.
Thank you so much for starting us off with that call. I appreciate it. Let's go now to lost my call screen here. Let's go to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello, hello. My favorite of all time was Frasier. Frasier was superb, I think, because the language was so cleverly used. The words were just magical. I just can't give enough applause to Frasier.
Now, that was on the list. The reason I lost my call screen is I'm trying to go through the list here to see where it ended up. I know it was in there. Thank you so much for that call with the recommendation of Frasier. We'll go to Ethan next in Madison. Ethan, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to bring up It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I think it's the longest-running sitcom now. It's super meta, super funny, not afraid to pull, or doesn't pull punches. Really funny show.
And have you stuck with it through the whole run, Ethan? Because it has been on a long time.
I have not watched the most recent season or two, but up until that point, I think I'd seen every season like 3 times.
Excellent. Thanks, Ethan. That one is on the list. You could join in. We're talking about the best sitcoms of all time. Rolling Stone had a top 100 list out last week. You could join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. There is a longer-running sitcom. If sitcoms include animation, and this list thinks they do, because number one is The Simpsons. Let's give a listen to when Lisa decides to become a vegetarian in the 7th season.
What's wrong, Lisa? Didn't you get enough lamb chops?
I can't eat this. I can't eat a poor little lamb.
Lisa, get a hold of yourself. This is lamb, not a lamb.
What's the difference between this lamb and the one that kissed me?
This one spent 2 hours in the broiler.
So that's The Simpsons. Even with the later seasons not as good as the first ones, it made number one best sitcom of all time on this Rolling Stone list. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Waupaca. David, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What's your favorite, David?
Well, of all time, you know, you said of all time, so mm-hmm. I think MASH.
Okay.
I agree with the first gentleman there because it's so well, it just interwove the tragedy and the suffering and the, you know, the humanity of, and put the humor in it. It had the humor and the drama. It was all blended together very well by the writer.
Sure. And did you have another one to throw at us, David?
Yeah, Norman Lear was a great writer too, with All in the Family and moving on up in that. But the other one was the Beverly Hillbillies, because I'm a long-haired country boy from Wisconsin, and I appreciate the hillbilly ways. So they're, you know, the hillbillies always crack me up, and no matter how many times I've seen the episode, it still cracks me up.
All right, time to go for a swim in the cement pond, David. Thank you so much. Let's go to Bruno now in Pleasant Prairie. Bruno, hi. Oh, we lost Bruno. He was going to say The IT Crowd, which I think did not make the list. Let's go to Cindy now in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Well, Seinfeld has got to be on the list.
It is. It is number three on the list. Simpsons, Cheers, then Seinfeld. Why is it number one for you, Cindy?
Well, like your one lady said, she thought Frasier was brilliant. I thought Seinfeld was just brilliant.
All right. Thank you so much, Cindy. Great to hear what our regular listeners like in sitcoms. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org with your favorites. The top five, I should say, Simpsons, Cheers, Seinfeld, I Love Lucy, and All in the Family. Let's go next to Willie with us in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. I want to put in a vote for one called Northern Exposure. It got criticized as for some of its political content because it was extremely multicultural. I found it very funny and very interesting and quirky.
That didn't make the list, really. And I think, was that an hour-long show? Because I think they restricted it to half hours without sort of that drama arc of an hour show.
Only talking about half hours, yeah, well... All in the Family was probably the most innovative and new when it first came out.
And that's what they said. That was number five on their list. Willie, thank you so much for sharing that. Well, thanks to everyone who called in. You can keep sharing your favorite sitcom of all time. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. A vote for The Office just came in. I think both the British and American offices made the list. Coming up, low temperatures in northern Wisconsin last month forced migrating loons out of the sky. We'll talk about how some were rescued and why the state's loon numbers have dropped in recent decades. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. One of our most recognizable birds has been returning to northern Wisconsin over the past few weeks. You might recognize its call. That's the common loon, which migrates north this time of year for its breeding season. Late last month, though, loons fell to the ground in Wisconsin after icy conditions made it impossible for some of them to keep flying. That kind of fallout event is rare, but it's just one danger loons face. Research shows that over the last 30 years, their numbers have dropped in Wisconsin as their shoreline habitats have changed. Marge Gibson is founder of the Raptor Education Group in Anago. She helped rescue some of the grounded loons in her area. Marge, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Walter Piper is a professor of biology at Chapman University and a scientist with the National Loon Center. You can find his work on Wisconsin loons at loonproject.org. Walter, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Marge, can you tell us a little more about what happened a couple of weeks back with this fallout during the migration?
Well, we had a situation where we had an unusual atmospheric condition, whereas it was we had kind of warm weather for a bit and it was raining. And then at altitude, there was a cold front and it was forming ice crystals or ice droplets. That was exactly what the loons were migrating through. And unfortunately, it landed on the loons and sort of coated them with this clear ice. This is something that's happened three times since I've been back in Wisconsin since 1990. So it's not an event that occurs all the time, but it is an interesting problem that our migrating birds face, especially the larger bodied birds like a loon.
And Marge, you and others were able to successfully help at least some of these loons get back into the air?
Oh, yes. We just released our eighth one. And beyond that, those are the birds that were admitted with injuries from falling. They fall like a rock from the sky, not a gentle landing like they're used to. So they do sustain internal bleeding, sometimes collapsed lungs, other types of internal injuries. So it takes a little bit for them to get back to normal, and then they're released when that happens. The good thing is we didn't lose any that came in as patients. People were reporting finding them and releasing them on small ponds, which we're still trying to capture them out of and then get them back to larger water.
And Walter, this is a rare event, as Marge said, but you've been investigating longer-term trends for northern Wisconsin's loons. What has been happening with the population?
Well, nothing good. The last 30 years, I've been working on them for 29 years now. This will be my 29th year coming up. And an analysis that we've done of reproductive rates and also survival rates of young adults has shown that those have both fallen. Fewer chicks have been fledged by pairs, and also young adult survival has plummeted. And so the overall population in our study area, which is mainly in Oneida County, it covers about 10% of the entire state, has plummeted about 22% in the last quarter century. So we're pretty alarmed about the pattern.
Do we know what's causing that decline?
No, we don't. That's the $128,000 question. We know a lot of different factors that hurt loons and could be causing it. And of course, we're having just recently found this pattern. We're looking feverishly to try to find a cause. We have a number of potential suspects, but nothing definite. We want to be very careful in before we point the finger. So we haven't yet been able to do that.
And Marge, can you talk about handling loons, which you have done as part of this effort to get them back in the air? We want to be really careful and maybe leave it to the experts.
Right, exactly. Loons are one of the more dangerous birds that we handle here at Reggie, and we do an awful lot of eagles and so on and so forth. But loons have that dagger on the front of their face that they can use really successfully. It's their hunting technique as well. So it really requires some expert handling when you're faced with one, unless it's very, very sick, very injured, that sort of thing. We do have people help us handle them, but we give them some really clear instructions before that happens.
Now, Walter, you mentioned that we don't know exactly why populations are going down, but that said, are there things we can do that we know are going to help loons, especially when it comes to things like habitat?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the factors that we know is statistically hurting the population, or at least hurting adult survival, is simply the number of humans around. And of course, that's something that we can scratch our heads about and be frustrated, I suppose, but it can't really reverse that trend easily. You can give loons space when you see them on the water, slow down when you see the adults, and especially when you see the chicks. The smaller the chicks, the slower you should go. But really, their impacts, the main impacts that we can make, the positive impacts that humans can have to do with recreational activity, especially fishing activity. For example, lead sinkers are a major source of mortality for loons, and they seem worse and worse, and Marge can talk more about that as the years go on. And it seems a fairly easy lift to say, hey, we got to stop using lead sinkers, and we got to fish more carefully, and we've got to report loons that are in trouble, that are caught in fishing lines and caught on fishing lines. So those sorts of adjustments we hope to see. Other states have made them. New England states have banned lead. Minnesota is in the process of doing so, it seems. And so we're a step behind, I'm afraid, in that regard in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Marge, what do you see when it comes to lead in water or even on land with loons and other birds?
Well, we're seeing more loons come in with lower levels of lead, and we're not exactly sure how that affects them in a sublethal way, but we are testing all of them. But when they swallow a lead sinker, for instance, that's not something that they can recover from unless it's surgically removed. So we do that here. Our veterinarians do the lavage method to remove them, but it is a complicated process. So I think that just as Walter was saying, just changing some of our habits and becoming more responsible for the wildlife around us is really an important thing, whether it's taking care of fishing line and fishing hooks, don't throw them out. Be sure that they're disposed of permanently and in a way that no other animal can get them. Power boats, loons can't get out of the way when they have chicks. The chicks can't fly. So don't race at them because they're going to be injured. So there's a lot of things that just using common sense and respect for wildlife will go a long way in helping.
And Walter, you've been looking at the loons here in Wisconsin for quite a while. What kind of questions are you still working on to try to answer?
Well, I'm a behavioral ecologist, so the truth is that I am first someone who's interested in the territorial behavior, and that's been we've had a rich trove of discoveries just with respect to territorial behavior. But because suddenly I see that the population seems to be declining, I've suddenly turned more into an ecologist, and now I'm desperately trying to figure out what's hurting the loon population. But, you know, among my findings are findings such as the male loons are the ones, surprisingly, that select the nest site. And we know that from all of our marks, a marking of birds and following of the pairs very, very closely. Surprisingly, the males choose the nest sites. Males fight harder than females. Both sexes fight for territories, but males fight a bit harder and more often die in battle than females. We also know that loons that are hatched and reared on small lakes seek to settle on small lakes 4 to 6 years later when they themselves have reached adulthood and are competing for a territory. So a loon from a very big lake is going to try to find another big lake for its own breeding purposes. So those are a few of the findings.
Interesting. We'll leave it there for now. Walter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Thank you.
And Marge, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Marge Gibson is a founder of the Raptor Education Center in Antigo, and Walter Piper is a loon expert and professor at Chapman University. You can find his research at loonproject.org. They talked to us about threats facing Wisconsin's loons and a rare fallout event last month when icy conditions stranded the birds, some of them during their migration north. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guests look at treatment for men who commit domestic abuse in the hopes of preventing future crimes. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out how President Biden's education plan could affect Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.